For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
Welcome to Books and Arts Daily on RN Online and on your ABC Radio app. I'm Michael Williams, and if the music's different, something's going on. And it's not that we have an orchestra in the studio, it's the last Friday of the month. It's time for European Classics, and we've got a biggie this month. It's Crime and Punishment, that's right, late 19th century, and one of the greatest modern Russian novelists, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Franz Kafka considered him a blood brother, even though they were a generation apart. Philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche described Dostoevsky as the only psychologist from which he had anything to learn. And more recently, Nobel laureate J.M. Coetzee wrote a novel based on him. The fact that I like most of all is apparently it was bedtime reading for Nick Cave when he was a child, which explains an awful lot. An interesting choice, given that it's the story delving into the mind of a murderer.
Can I really take a hatchet? Crack a skull? Slither about in warm, sticky blood? Steal and shake with fear? Good God, is it possible?
It's the story, for those just catching up for the first time, of Rodion Raskolnikov, a law student dropout living in poverty in St. Petersburg. He decides to kill a nasty, unscrupulous pawnbroker. After all, as he says, it's for the greater good. It's his job to rid the world of worthless vermin. Some people have a natural and intellectual right to commit crimes to improve society. But then he kills an innocent who walks in, and it all gets a little bit murky. And 900 pages later, we might or might not get to some punishment. We are joined in the studio by three people who have immersed themselves in this psychological tale of murder and redemption, all in the name of a European classic book club. And I'd like to welcome them to the studio now. Elliot Perlman is a best-selling author, most recently of the critically acclaimed The Street Sweeper. He's also a practicing barrister, so knows a thing or two about ridding the world of vermin, one way or the other. Hi, Elliot.
Good morning, Michael. I don't know about ridding the world of vermin, but thank you for having me.
Joining us from Brisbane is Melissa Lukashenko. Her book, Malambimbi, has just won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing. She's also a co-founder of Sisters Inside, an organisation advocating rights for women in prison. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, Michael.
Thanks so much for joining us. And last but not least on our panel of experts is Andrew O'Keefe. He's a filmmaker, award-winning playwright and lecturer in film at the Victorian College of the Arts. And he's currently in post-production of a modern adaptation of Crime and Punishment himself. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Michael. Welcome.
Okay, so we've got a big task ahead of us today for the European Classics Book Club. I'd like to remind you listening at home that you can join in. Don't forget, you can tweet us at RN Books and Arts or even text us on 0418 22 6576. You can also jump onto our website. There's a Crime and Punishment Book Club page and you can comment away there. And we'll see if I've even vaguely got the aptitude to talk about what you've told us. I doubt it. Extremely, but it'd be nice to have. Now, the three of you, Crime and Punishment, I know you're very diligent, you've boned up for the book club, but tell me, I might start with you, Andrew, when did you first read it?
When I first read it completely was only about 2 or 3 years ago. I actually first tried to read this book in, I must have been 15 years old, so 20 more plus years ago, 25 years ago, and I think I got about 20 pages into it and thought, this is boring and nothing's happening, and so I let it go. And then about, I would have been 30, 32, 33, 10 years later, I decided I'm going to have another crack at this novel. I got a much further into it, but I didn't finish the book. I got further into it, probably just to around the killing, part of the killing, and I just did not like the character. I felt him repulsive, and there was no, completely joyless, and I don't know why I was surprised. It was Dostoevsky and Crime and Punishment, but so I wasn't expecting Pride and Prejudice or anything like that.
I like you were disappointed at the joylessness of it. You got just to the murder and you went, yeah, this is not a funny murder.
Yeah. And then My wife is from half Finnish, and we went to Finland a few years ago and did a side trip to St. Petersburg. And I thought, okay, I've got to read some Crime and Punishment before we get to St. Petersburg, because, you know, that's where it's all happening. And so on this trip of, but that was, it must have been early, late 2012. Between then and now, I'd say I've read it four or five, six times now. Well, once in the last week. Because I read it before we arrived to St. Petersburg and just absolutely floored me. I didn't know why. I think it was my age. I wasn't, I don't know, maybe emotionally aware enough or something in the times I tried to read it before. And it just, I absolutely loved it. I just thought it was an amazing story and psychology and character.
Maybe you got to a point of your life where you stopped expecting joy in things.
Probably the case.
That's a pretty depressing endorsement for the book. But yeah. Clearly it's inspired you. It's inspired you to do your own stuff. We're going to come back to that a bit later on. Yeah. But I might throw to you, Elliot. You came to it the first time in your late 20s?
Late teens, early 20s, which is, you know, perhaps the best time to read this novel, I think. I was, university student, surrounded by other university students who were loudly professing their individuality as they tried on different ideologies for size, different fashions of various extremes. And around this time, I'm catching Melbourne trams to go to work in a part-time job, and I'm reading Crime and Punishment on the tram in my lunch break. And with all of this background, it was easy for me to actually see Raskolnikov, the poverty-stricken former student in this crowded city who saw and stepped over drunks and the wretched poor, who flirted with extreme ideas and with the idea of being an intellectual, whether he really was or not is a debatable matter, but and whose realization that the world was unfair, this seemed to him an original realization, and whose solution was rash, ill-considered, self-serving, violent, and dressed up as a rational conclusion to an ideological consideration, and ultimately corrosive of his soul. So it was easy for me to see this guy because he was sitting next to me in economics.
I like that you just prosecuted him in a single go there. That's it. Raskolnikov, you're gone. I reckon if he'd been on the tram with you, he would have been a fair evader because he would have thought that that was for the greater good as well.
Absolutely.
That's my read of his character.
Nihilists don't pay fares on public transit.
No, nihilists don't own Mikeys. We're going to dig a bit deeper into the character of Raskolnikov in a moment. But, Melissa, I'm going to bring you in here. Was your reading with it, your discovery of it, similar to our other panellists?
Not really. I was told by an Aboriginal elder in 1998 that I needed to read Dostoevsky, and I dutifully nodded and trotted off to the library and I think opened The Brothers Karamazov and maybe read 10 pages and promptly put it down. And it wasn't until about 2 weeks ago that I had my second crack at Dostoevsky, and now I can go to Auntie Mary Graham and very proudly say, yes, I've done what you told me to do 16 years ago and I've read what I was supposed to.
That's a slightly belated book report, but I think that's okay. How did you find it on your second crack?
It's a hard read. It's a big, long book, and, you know, he was a great fan of Dickens, and like Dickens, there's 70,000 characters to plough through and to try and assemble into some kind of coherent place in your mind as a reader, and all the Russian names and the doubled Russian names don't make it any easier as a read, but... Yeah, I did end up getting into it, and the opposite of, I think, what Andrew said, about the time of the murder, I started to really get what Dostoevsky was doing, and it began to cohere for me.
So, just to bring the listeners up to speed who have read it years ago, obviously, and have not come back to it, or those who haven't discovered it before, Andrew, you're a filmmaker, you have adapted this work, so you've had to think about what the bare bones of the structure and the plot are. Give us a little summary for our listeners. Tell them about Raskolnikov and the story.
Right, I didn't expect that.
An ambush question.
Well, 50 characters down to a single sentence. The I can give you the, what would you call it, the synopsis that's on the website that I've made. That's probably the easiest way. It's only two paragraphs. It is the story of a nihilistic PhD student who commits, a desperate and downtrodden PhD student who commits murder in the name of a theory, which I won't go into the theory as right now, but the theory of the extraordinary man, only to discover, much to his disdain, that he may have been wrong. And it's his journey to confess to that murder by the end of the film before his soul is irredeemable. That's probably my...
No, that's pretty good. I reckon that touches most of the keynotes. Redemption, an intellectual theory that is tested through murder.
Mm.
Earlier in the week, I had a chance to speak to a woman called Adjunct Professor Millicent Vladov-Glover. She's from Monash University in Melbourne, and she's a lecturer in comparative literature, and she's also the Australian representative of the International Dostoevsky Society and chief editor of the Dostoevsky Journal, an independent review. She is obviously a passionate reader of Dostoevsky's work, and I had a chat to her about him and his significance.
He had a very hard life. He saw life in the raw, and he represented life in the raw in his novels.
Why does Dostoevsky survive like he does? Why is he so highly rated as a psychologist in world literature?
Because he is one. He understood the limits of human experience, and that's what he is representing. And everybody who came after him has followed in his footsteps. Every European writer who was well-read and, of course, under the impact of world literature, has taken a cue out of Dostoevsky's book and has continued to describe the limits of human experience, the limits of human language, the possibilities of human language. That's what the literature of the absurd is all about. That's what Beckett is all about, for example.
Edward Snowden's lawyer? When,
yes.
You may be familiar with this, but when he gave the National Security Agency whistleblower a copy of Crime and Punishment with some clean shirts, he gave it to him when he got to Moscow Airport, and he said, "You have to read this to understand about our reality of life." Is it a singularly Russian work? Does it tell us something about what it is to be Russian?
Absolutely not. That is absolute bollocks.
Excellent.
If I can say that word on television,
no,
on radio.
You absolutely can. The clean shirts are a better gift than Crime and Punishment.
Well, Crime and Punishment would not teach him about Russian life. It would teach him about life. Because there's nothing terribly Russian about Crime and Punishment except the language in which it is written and except the setting. But even the setting is, although it is St. Petersburg, and you can find concrete places where the different squares where Raskolnikov traverses in his agony of after the crime and before the crime and so on, before the crimes, I should say, because he kills two people. These are all psychic landscapes. You know, it's like something out of Salvador Dali's dreamscapes. It is the concrete St. Petersburg, but it's the concreteness of a nightmare.
Well, I'm curious. Think comparative literature. What is it that Australian readers today might particularly take from Dostoevsky?
The universality of Dostoevsky, that it could be any one of us. Well, I remember when I read Crime and Punishment, I was only in my undergraduate years, and I remember how tortured I was in empathy with the torture experienced by Raskolnikov. If you can whip up such empathy in a reader through your characters, you are doing something right. Because you're developing empathy, and empathy is the best instrument we have for social bonding and social interaction.
Millicent, are you about to secretly confess that you killed someone as an intellectual exercise in your undergraduate years? Because I should warn you, this is being broadcast. They're going to come and get you. We're going to hear more from Millicent Vladov-Glover later in the hour, academic and murderer. terrific to have a chance to talk to her. But... look, there's the key question, that question of empathy. Listeners, you're listening to RN. This is Books Announced Daily, and I'm Michael Williams, talking as part of our European Classics Book Club. We're talking Crime and Punishment, and I want to know, have you read it? Did you empathise with Raskolnikov? Send us a tweet at RN Books and Arts or a text on 0418 226576. Or you can jump on the Books and Arts website and leave your comments on the dedicated page. Listener Natalie has written in. She studied it at Flinders Uni, English 1, which shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the word English, but what are you going to do? She said, I'd read Russian authors at home back in Latin America and was accustomed to how long the stories were. But this one I understood very well, i.e. the inner struggle to justify what you've done. I identified with Raskolnikov, but still thought that it took too long to come to the end. Leaving aside the critique of the 900 pages, that question of identifying with the novel's anti-hero, Elliot, did you identify with the killer?
I had different experiences each time I read it. The first time I read it in late teens, early 20s, I was perhaps more sympathetic to people toying with ideas and trying different shades of different ideologies on for size. And, you know, when you're younger, I guess you're more like wet cement for that sort of thing, which might be why extremists tend to look for young people to recruit. When I read it again recently for today's program, I was much less sympathetic to Raskolnikov. It wasn't that in my early 20s I didn't find abhorrent the idea that you could, for an intellectual exercise, kill somebody to try and make a point or prove a theory. But now, I'm scared to admit, 30 years later, it was just immediately abhorrent. So I sympathised with him less, or I empathised with him less, but I still think that it's part of the genius of Dostoevsky that you stay with him. As abhorrent as he is, you stay with him, and the reason is, and in a sense you can find this in great anti-heroes of, you know, today's popular television like Tony Soprano, you understand it, and there's a little part of you that's like that. That doesn't mean that we are all murderers. Most of us, thankfully, aren't. But you understand the notion of guilt incredibly well, and Dostoevsky does that so well, among other things, that you stay with it. And there are many other reasons for staying with it, but you do retain some empathy for this really abhorrent character, Raskolnikov.
I mean, my feeling is that 900 pages, you know, that thing of what keeps you in and what drags you along is fundamentally important. Melissa, obviously it's a distraction to think that we have to sympathise or empathise with the main characters in the books that we read. But how did you find Raskolnikov?
A bit like Elliot, I think. And again, firstly, I would question whether Raskolnikov's guilt is actually such a huge feature of the book, which might seem like an odd thing to say because, you know, he's a tortured character for most of the 900 pages, but I don't think his torture is about guilt. He actually says on page 543, my conscience is clear. And he also says that he did not, the author says, he did not find any especially terrible guilt in his past, except perhaps a simple blunder that could have happened to anyone. So I don't think his torture is about guilt exactly, whether it's about being crazed, whether it's about fearing being put in prison or what it is. I don't think guilt is quite the right word. But as with Elliot, I don't know about Andrew, but Elliot and I have both worked with people in the criminal justice system for many years, and we've both known murderers. And when you understand that murder is a very ordinary fact of life, then it somehow takes on more significance. You know, murder is real. Murder happens to real people and has real consequences. And because of that, I found Raskolnikov interesting but quite repellent, and I had no, or almost no empathy for him at all.
Andrew, I understand you felt a little more empathy for Raskolnikov.
I did a lot more, actually. I don't know any murderers, so I'm not. I don't have that background to draw on, which is a really interesting point. Actually, it's not something I'd considered. But for me, I think he does feel guilt, and he may not say it, just because there's two sides to this character, and one of which is the words he speaks out to people in most of the time, which is in defence of his own intellectual theories about the extraordinary man and how, you know, he had the right to do this, or he's testing whether he has the right to do this crime. But the acts that he does, aside from the murder, is he gives money away to people who are more desperate than him, or he considers more desperate than him. he helps people. He he saves a number of characters from rape, from who knows what in throughout the novel. One of the things I think that Dostoevsky has done very cleverly inside the novel to allow you to empathise with Raskolnikov more are the two characters of Svidrigaïlov and Luzin. They're both totally repulsive characters. One's a pedophile who revels in that fact, and the other one, kind of like Raskolnikov, thinks he's above everybody but enacts that in a way that keeps everybody else downtrodden, whereas Raskolnikov is trying to lift himself out. So I think the structure of the way the book is written gives you empathy as well, just because of those two characters. He's not the worst person in it, even though he's a killer.
There is also a hope for a redemptive arc. I mean, you spend much of the book hoping, you know, he agonises about whether to confess for a good solid 450 or so pages, which, you know, that's narrative efficiency. But if he were a suspect in an episode of Law and Order, he would be terrible at being a criminal. Like, he's taken into a police station not long after the murders happen, and he's there because his landlady is trying to get money out of him because he's behind on his rent. And someone mentions the murder of the pawnbroker and her sister, and he promptly faints in the police station. Now, that's not a great way to hide your own guilt, I wouldn't have thought, Elliot. As a lawyer, would you advise your clients to faint any time the crime's mentioned?
No, it's not a good look. It's not going to help you. But look, there's something very interesting about the question of empathy, and I wonder, particularly with Melissa's experience, if you find yourself, Melissa, drawing a distinction between probably most people that commit murder doing it in an act of spontaneous rage, and frequently they didn't intend to, and after they've done it, they wished they didn't do it, as opposed to the murders here, where they are, well, the first one, is quite coldly and calculatingly planned, almost according to, you know, well, according to some, you know, bizarre ideology. And that's extra repulsive. I mean, nobody condones murder, or very few people do, but it's one thing where it happens in what might be called a crime of passion, which doesn't make it excusable, but it's that much worse when it's planned in an almost theoretical way. And not only that, the theory itself is not the only reason for doing it. He does it for self-interested economic reasons, which makes him that much more despicable. And I wondered if Melissa, if you made the same distinction.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Elliot. And of course, in court, that would be, you know, a crime of passion, I think, is, you know, is slightly mitigating as opposed to malice aforethought or whatever it's called. And then there's also an interesting point, which is that at the time of writing the book, which was written in serial form, it was written in 12 chunks for a magazine. In the very early stages of writing, I believe that Dostoevsky himself didn't actually know what the motive was going to be. And I think that's why it's so unclear early on, or at least it was unclear early on to me. And it wasn't until much, much later in the book that I felt that Dostoevsky was saying it was absolutely about this sort of quasi-Nietzschean theory of the Superman and stepping over the boundaries that limit mere mortals. But I thought he was quite confused as a character up till the time of committing the murder, and even after that,
I think that question of motive is really interesting, and I'd like to get to the theory in a moment. But first, both of your comments are echoed by listener Eve, who left a comment on our website. Her lack of sympathy for Raskolnikov was because she thinks he killed because he could. He was detached from reality, cruel, without remorse or even regret, judgmental, contemptuous, and a thief. She asks, was he a psychopath? Certainly his contempt for others and his lack of remorse would indicate that he was. You both touched upon the theory, though, that he puts up as his kind of as one of his self-justifications, possibly a little bit after the event. The theory around the kind of the Napoleon figure. We'll hear a little clip, and then I'd like to talk about that.
Good God. Here I am thinking of doing such a thing, and I'm all in a jitter. Well, of course. Everything is in a man's own hands. And if he lets it all slip through his fingers, that's sheer cowardice. What do people fear most? What they're most afraid of is taking a new step.
Or uttering a new word.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Williams, and it's time for our European Classics Book Club. We're talking about Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, because nothing says Friday like nihilism and the theory of a Superman who's allowed to do whatever they like. I'm talking to our panel of experts, Elliot Pillman, Melissa Lukashenko, and Andrew O'Keefe, and we're just touching upon Raskolnikov's motivation for the murder, and he puts up this big theory, the idea of the extraordinary man, that there are two classes of people, kind of Napoleon, Muhammad, Newton, who are allowed to utter a new word, move the world, and lead it to its goal. This is where he lost me, to be honest. This seemed utterly unsympathetic as a motivation to me. What's your feeling, Elliot, about the intellectual who intellectualizes wrongdoing?
Well, you know, frankly, it's evil. And it's really interesting that that Nietzsche had a lot of time for Dostoevsky. There's quite an irony in that, because I think it might well be a misreading of Dostoevsky, because I think by the time you finish the novel, it's pretty clear that however Dostoevsky started, and Melissa touched on a really important issue here, which was we need to remember the book was written in serialization and he desperately needed money. So he didn't necessarily know how it was going to turn out, and he didn't necessarily know. He didn't have the luxury of considering his themes as, you know, he might have if he didn't need the money so badly. But by the time the novel ends, it's quite clear that Dostoevsky is not a proponent of this, what might be called a Nietzschean theory of the Übermensch or the Superman, that certain humans are superior to others in various ways, and that those humans therefore have the right to ignore the laws most of us have to obey, including the criminal law, which permits murder. And Dostoevsky was not in favour of that. But Nietzsche enjoyed Dostoevsky, admired him, and then proposed this idea of the superhuman, the Übermensch.
Andrew, how did you take the kind of the grand intellectual theory? Is it something that kind of resonates?
Yeah, I actually enjoyed that part of it quite a bit. Actually, it was I would say the film that I've made, the screenplay that I adapted to it plays much more along that theory, and it's his struggle with his own intellectual life and abilities is what I've focused the story on. And I find it a very interesting theory, just because, I mean, it's still relevant today. It's, you know, people start wars and all sorts of things in the name of a smaller act. And yes, I might commit a murder, but my life is going to have repercussions that are going to be for the greater good, and all those things will forgiven. So it's the almost the ultimate question of how much is a single life worth. That, and I think this is the thing that actually makes the book so relevant and will always be relevant, because it's one of the first times that question is put up in a novel, and then the whole novel resonates around that idea. So I think, and it's, you know, it's his struggle. Did he, until he does the killing, it's about him, does he dare do it? And once he does dare do it, he knows that the question for him, and he says it before the killing, is, can I cope with my own conscience afterwards, and that would make me an extraordinary being? Of which he kind of sees that in Svidrigaïlov's character, who seems to be above the law and has lived this life of debauchery and all sorts of things, and seems to have, right up until the end, seems to have got out of that. He has become this extraordinary person as far as Raskolnikov is concerned, yet even he succumbs to his own conscience in the end and kills himself. So I think I agree that Dostoevsky gets to the end and says, no, that theory, you can't base your life around that theory because it's not going to work. And every character who in the book who does attempt to, it is a downward plunge for them. But I think it's fascinating. I think it's a very fascinating element of the book, probably the most fascinating, actually.
I mean, it's interesting the extent to which the theory is just justification and the extent to which, I think, Elliot, before you touched upon the fact that he has other motivations. He does steal the money from the pawnbroker. He is kind of hoping to improve his own lot in life. Listener Elizabeth texted in, a little more sympathetic to Raskolnikov, and says, having experienced poverty and the limitations it imposes gives one an insight. It's an interesting thought, Melissa. How much do you think this is, you know, you touch upon the context that the book was written in. How much is this a story of class in Russia and poverty in Russia at the time?
I think Dostoevsky was one of the few, like Dickens in England, or one of the earliest, rather, to look at the lives of the poor. But really this book is a shift away from a literature of the landowning class to a literature of the lower middle class, because Raskolnikov is a student, his friend Razumikin, who's also very, very poor, almost in the same situation as Raskolnikov, and doesn't commit murder, doesn't seek, have this kind of sociopathic need to transgress the social order. He's poor. Obviously, the Marmeladov family are in terrible, aching poverty. So, issues of poverty, issues of the newly freed serfs who are coming to St. Petersburg, and, you know, it's a new era, and the poverty in the book is very, very stark. About a third of the way through, I realised how this would strike a mainstream Australian reader, that, you know, everyone is really, really poor, but because I'm Aboriginal, I see a great deal of poverty in my everyday life, and it hadn't quite hit me until then how a mainstream reader would be interpreting this. But that is no excuse for going around murdering, and the idea that some lives are worth less than other lives is an incredibly dangerous and an incredibly seductive idea. And I take this book as, my most charitable interpretation of the book is as a warning about the dangers of extremism and of saying that your life is worth less than anybody else's life.
Melissa, I think that's a really important point. Could you, for our listeners, just expand upon the Marmeladovs a bit and talk about that family and what they're going through in the book?
Yeah, the Marmeladovs, the father Marmeladov is a failed bureaucrat. And originally Dostoevsky was interested in writing about drunkenness and the effect that drunkenness had on the social order. And he had conceived of that as a different book, and it made its way into Crime and Punishment. He collapsed two potential novels into the one. Marmeladov is a drunk, he's dissipated, and his family has been cast into poverty because he's lost his job after going on one binge too many. His second wife is a brutal woman who mistreats his children, his young children, really badly. She's a horrible person. And his eldest daughter has been forced into prostitution to support the family because he's, you know, such a loser, basically. And it's Sonia who is the now horribly clichéd whore with a heart of gold, who becomes Raskolnikov's girlfriend towards the end of the book. And she's this pitiful, suffering martyr figure, you know, the doormat of doormats, I like to call her, who's been driven to this because her father has, you know, chosen the bottle above supporting his family. You know, yet another lucky, lucky woman in the world Dostoevsky.
I was going to say, women fare pretty well in Crime and Punishment. No, they have a pretty good run, by and large. Elliot, Sonia, doormat?
She is a doormat, but she's also, I think, in a larger sense, she's almost Christ-like. She serves that role of being the source of redemption. And I think Dostoevsky, while in his life he tried out various ideological stances, if you could characterise his worldview on the whole, you would say he was a Slavophile. That means, you know, one of those Russians that was opposed to the westernising influence over Russia, particularly in the 19th century, and also a devout Russian Orthodox Christian, and perhaps the only place where he sort of slightly deviates from traditional Christianity would be, rather than seeking redemption through Christ, he just takes a slight turn to the right and says, you receive redemption through your own suffering, and that's where Sonia comes in.
This question of redemption and religion is a really interesting one, and actually somewhat contentious when it comes to considering Dostoevsky in his own life. We heard earlier from adjunct professor Millicent Vladov-Glover, and we're going to go back to her again. She actually takes exception to the idea that the best way to understand Dostoevsky is as a conservative Christian.
Yes, absolutely. Dostoevsky's Christianity is a myth, including people in my society, in the International Dostoevsky Society. I have many dear colleagues who fervently believe in Dostoevsky as a Christian thinker. Dostoevsky was not an Orthodox thinker. He was a European phenomenologist.
But so taking Crime and Punishment as a case in point, you don't take the symbolism around Sonia placing the cross around Raskolnikov's neck. That's not a Christian act, to your mind?
Everything in a literary work is metaphor. Nothing is as it seems, and nothing is a copy of reality. And it's a metaphoric representation. So you have to decode the metaphors in the light of the work itself, not in the light of some external system of value, external system of belief. Now, the internal system of value and the internal system of belief is one which is thoroughly grounded in the poetics of realism, which means the poetics of representing, for Dostoevsky, the subjectivity of the 19th century Russian universal man. I say man in a non-sexist, non-gender sense, as a universal concept of humanity.
That's as close as I come to contradicting adjunct professor Millicent Vladov-Glover, because she scared me, frankly. And she knew what she was talking about. But I am...
She'd read the book.
Well, you know, she really, several times over. But it is an interesting question. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN, online and on the ABC Radio app. I'm Michael Williams, and I'm talking to Elliot Perlman, Melissa Lukashenko and Andrew O'Keefe about our European Classics Book Club pick for this month, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Listener comments are pouring in, and they're really fantastic. People have a passionate and personal connection to this book. Tony texted in and said, it had a huge influence on me, and the thing that really struck me is it's about the human condition. It transcends its socio-historic context, which is a lovely thought. And David has also commented on the website. He said, Sonia is Raskolnikov's opposite, the pure, the good, and the selfless. She'll commit herself to his resurrection like a religion. It's something to reach for, a saviour. That seems to me to reinforce the point you were making earlier, Elliot. Even if everything in a novel is metaphor, can't help but think a cross around the neck is a slightly gaudy metaphor. Is that just me?
Well, for a start, I'd agree with that. There's enough Christian metaphors in the novel not to mention the end of the book, to make you say that if you had to give him a worldview, and he had many different worldviews during his life, you'd have to say, yes, it was Russian Orthodox Christianity. But I even take issue with the point that everything in a novel is a metaphor. Some things are just those things. Yes. I remember hearing Joseph Heller give a talk, the author of Catch-22, among many others, and he was asked by a very very serious young PhD student in the audience, could you talk about themes of insanity in your novels? And he said, what do you mean? And he listed a few characters, and then he came to the character of the grandmother in the novel Good as Gold, and he said, and Joseph Heller said, she's not insane, she's just a bitch.
Joseph Heller's capacity for straight talking is wonderful. He was asked by someone why he hadn't written a good book since Catch-22, and he said, why hasn't anyone else? There's a certain kind of bravado there that is admirable. But I digress. Andrew, how do you feel about religious themes? Is your film full of religious iconography?
No, it's not, but I did treat it as a metaphor, the religious side of it, purely from a personal context, because I'm not a religious person. However, when I read the book and enjoyed it, the religious side of it purely worked as a metaphor for me for the redemption of his soul, whereas, say, the Porphyry character worked to redeem his intelligence the Sonya character and the religion. You know, it's capped off at the moment he puts the cross around his neck. Having said that, as soon as he has put the cross around his neck, he goes down to the Haymarket, I think it is, and is about to, well, he does bow down and kiss the soil, and he's about to yell out that I'm a murderer. And a couple of people start having a go at him again, and he decides, and I think the words in the translation I read were, he steals himself and doesn't commit that confession there. So whether he actually ever embraces, look, by the very last passage, I think he probably has embraced Christianity due to the raising of Lazarus passages that are long and fairly tedious, I actually found, I must admit, through the book. But that's only my own personal biases coming through. But so I took it completely as a visual metaphor, and I enjoyed it for that, and I've used that in the film we've made. But it's more about his soul and finding a heavenly, inverted commas, place for it rather than going to church.
I should warn you to be careful in saying critical things about the book. Someone claiming to be Fyodor Dostoevsky has commented on our website. I'm not saying that I believe that it's genuinely him, but he has some supportive things to say about the book. You'll be unsurprised to hear. Says, of course you can identify with Raskolnikov. He's a young man with utilitarian views, just badly managed. Dostoevsky has the ability to sum a character up like no other author. Your acceptance of that as being really Dostoevsky depends on whether you think he'd talk about himself in the third person, but your mileage may vary. Listeners, you can still be part of this conversation. Send us a tweet at RN Books and Arts or a text on 0418 226 576. Leaving aside the question of religion, Elliot, you touched upon madness in the context of Joseph Heller a moment ago. When publisher Max Brod complained to Kafka that all Dostoevsky's characters are mad, Kafka replied, they're only incidentally mad. It's a most fruitful form of human presentation. We're all mad sometimes. Do you think madness plays a part in Crime and Punishment?
Yes, it does. You know, it's pretty obvious to me that Raskolnikov has mental illnesses, at least one, and his circumstances certainly make it much more likely that he's going to suffer from mental illness. But one of the things that makes Dostoevsky so great, and Crime and Punishment is a wonderful example of it, is that particularly Raskolnikov is more than one thing. So he's not only selfish and solipsistic and intellectually arrogant. He is at times the opposite of those things. And I think it's that, plus the guilt that he frequently feels but doesn't always feel, that helps you understand him, particularly as a young man. I don't know if young women suffer this as much, but in that late high school, university age, when young people are thinking about serious matters for the first time, they at least mentally, they conduct thought experiments and go to various extremes. Fortunately for us, few of them act on these extremes, but they consider them. And in a sense, had Raskolnikov not actually acted on it and killed somebody, two people, you might have had some sympathy. Even it's almost, to think of these things is almost endearing. To act on them is abhorrent.
That duality, Andrew, you touched upon it before in the context of Svidrigaylov. I'm just going to bungle that Russian name right there. But, you know, he is an odious character, and yet for much of the book, he's an odious character acting like one who's found redemption. Does duality play a big part in this book for you?
Yeah, I think so, and I think most of the characters, as one of the writers on the website said, I think most of the characters are reflective of an interesting one is that Raskolnikov sees himself as his mother, I suppose, in that letter she writes, sees himself as the head of his family, and he feels like he's failed that family, and then he sees a complete reflection of that in the Marmaladovs. So I've called them marmalades in the book, so it's much easier for me. So I think that's why he attaches himself to this family, because there's a reflection of them. And as someone says, I think Sonya is a direct reflection of his positive side, what his positive side could be. So to Porphyry, of what his positive side could be. Porphyry completely understands the extraordinary man side of it, yet doesn't you know, argues against it.
So just to pick you up on that, Porfiry Petrovich is the investigating magistrate, of course. And he, you know, that duality between the investigator and the criminal is one that's a very familiar archetype from literature. In fact, in the couple of years leading up to writing this, Dostoevsky had read and loved Les Miserables, and had, you know, the direct influence of that on this book, I think, is quite visible. That kind of the good cop and the tortured villain circling around each other. Yeah, there's a lot of fun, I think, in that part of the book as well, and fun's not a word we think of automatically when we talk about Crime and Punishment, but I do think the dynamic between those two has a real spark to it. Do you agree with that, Melissa?
Yeah, I do. I think that is one of the more interesting dynamics in the book. As far as fun, I think there's five pages of the 900-page book that I would call comic.
But they're in the middle, aren't they? So you really got to work for them.
You've got to work pretty hard. Yeah, Porfiry is a great character, irritating at times with his sort of circling around the topic and as with many of the characters, a kind of crazed approach to reality, but that's part of his strategy of trying to entrap Raskolnikov, I guess. I find it astonishing that anyone would say this isn't a Christian fable, almost, you know. And if, as the listener earlier said, that Sonya is Raskolnikov's opposite, then, you know, we have her as the Christ figure, we have him as the sinner, we have Lazarus, the Lazarus motif throughout. And to me, the whole book is saturated in this kind of sickening spectacle of Christian suffering as redemption. And, you know, Sonya says, he confesses to Sonya, and the line is, such suffering burst in a painful wail from Sonya. And she's not saying, oh, the poor woman whose head you've cleaved in with an axe, the two women. She's saying, you poor suffering sinner. And really, I just think it's quite sick-making. It made me think of that awful domestic violence case a couple of weeks ago where the man killed his family and then the next day the media's full of, oh, poor him, he must have been suffering so badly to do it.
Yeah, no, there is definitely something in Sonya's fawning over Raskolnikov throughout that is just a little bit off-putting. Look, we only have a little bit of time left, and I'm really keen to think about the lasting impact of this book and the kind of influence it has on literature that's come since and on our ideas of these kind of big stories. Where do you see it? I mean, often there's a divide between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Often you're a fan of one, and so you kind of disavow the other. Elliot, do you subscribe to that? And if so, are you Camp Fyodor or Camp Tolstoy?
I thought you were going to ask me that question. I've never liked the implicit assumptions of that ostensible rivalry. You know, first it takes attention away from the other great Russian writers, even, you know, of the 19th century, Turgenev, Gogol, to name a few. And then, of course, there's, you know, millions of them in the 20th century we need to be remembering. And then there's the suggestion that you have to choose between the two of them, that it's an either-or situation. I think it's possible to enjoy and admire both of them, and I have a quote from somebody who agreed. Can I read that quote? It's not very long.
Oh, no, you absolutely can, but I'm then going to accuse you of being mealy-mouthed and not choosing a side, but give us the quote.
That's fine. Just recently I was feeling unwell and read House of the Dead. I had forgotten a good bit, read it over again, and I do not know a better book in all our new literature, including Pushkin. It's not the tone, but the wonderful point of view. Genuine, natural, and Christian. A splendid, instructive book. I enjoyed myself the whole day as I've not done for a long time. If you see Dostoevsky, tell him that I love him. So wrote Leo Tolstoy.
Well, see, Tolstoy's allowed to like both of them because he likes himself. But, you know, if I said you John Lennon or Paul McCartney, I would expect an answer. They're not both equal, surely.
Have we got enough time to talk about Lennon versus McCartney?
That might be a whole separate hour. European classic rock.
I thought it was Lennon versus Trotsky. Hang on,
we'll go Lennon versus Trotsky in a moment. But there are famous detractors of Dostoevsky. I mean, most notably that notorious grump Vladimir Nabokov delivered a scathing lecture, saying he didn't like the ambiguity of Dostoevsky. He lacks taste. His characters are raving lunatics or characters from a madhouse. Poor, deformed, warped souls often no longer human, and that the books and characters were too sentimental. Melissa, what do you think of Nabokov's criticisms?
Oh, I'm with Nabokov. I've got a beautiful quote from him here saying that Dostoevsky is not a great writer, but rather a mediocre one with flashes of excellent humour, but alas, with wastelands of literary platitudes in between.
That is a cruel
review. Tolstoy for me. Tolstoy for me all the way.
That's not going on the front cover of the book, that's for sure. He's in furious agreement, though, it has to be said, with our listener David Stevens, who says it's rather loosely plotted. Raskolnikov's completely lacking in remorse or empathy. His final epiphany in the epilogue strikes me as completely unbelievable. So, yeah, not one for David either. Tolstoy, Dostoevsky.
I like the fact that in that quote that it's only when he's ill that he reaches for Dostoevsky. I thought that was a very telling. I'm in fever. Give me Raskolnikov.
That's right. When you're young or very sick.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't have either. I would say that just on the Nabokov side of it, my favourite book ever is Lolita. Yet they're not sane characters. He's written people who are equally as he's written it beautifully, and every sentence just is like a melody. But you know, the thing he's throwing at Dostoevsky there could be applied to his own books in a number of cases, I think. So it's a it's a wonderful argument, the whole thing, I think. But
we don't have time to hear another clip from Millicent Vladov Glover, but she made much the same point and said that you can see echoes of Dostoevsky all through Nabokov's work, and that influence was certainly there, even if he wasn't going to pay him the respect of acknowledging it, which is an interesting thought. So here we are in the 21st century. People are still reading it. We had one of our listeners, Robin Malitz, said Crime and Punishment's been required reading for her Year 12 students for the past 20 years. She finds their engagement is rewardingly intense, and the impact it has on these young people is profound. I have a collection of their evaluation statements singing its praises and conveying the message everyone should read this book. I'm interested, all three of you and several of the listeners who have commented today have talked about coming to it in different times of their life and either finding a great deal in it or nothing in it at all. Do you think it's a book that should be read at a particular age, and do you think it's a book that deserves to keep getting read? Elliot?
I think people who are interested in psychological novels, people who are interested in the historical development of the novel, people interested in the literary antecedents of Kafka, Joyce, Virginia Woolf, Hemingway, the Beats, and all the artists that they influenced, those people should read the book. People interested in Russian history should read the book, as well as people interested in Freud. Students of fine writing should read the book, but probably not everybody has to read the book. Occasionally, you will meet somebody and you look at them and you say, you know, you don't really have to read Crime and Punishment.
Oh, you're going to let a subset of society off the hook. I thought you were going to cover all of them in your list, but some of them don't need to. Melissa, briefly, should people be reading it?
People with insomnia should read the book. People who don't have insomnia should read a short story called Sound by a young writer called Ellen Van Nieuwen in her collection Heat and Light, which has just been released, about a sister with a sociopathic, violent brother and how the sister works with that brother to try and redeem him and ultimately fails. And they should go and see Andrew's film when it comes out.
Oh, that is seamless. I couldn't have wrapped things up on a better note there, Melissa. I've been talking to Elliot Perlman, Melissa Lukashenko, both best-selling and award-winning authors, and Andrew O'Keefe, a filmmaker and award-winning playwright and lecturer in film at the Victorian College of the Arts. His Crime and Punishment comes out next year. Thank you to all three of you for your contributions. It's been a terrific book club today.
Really good. Dospedanya, tovarich.
Oh, we should have had you do the whole thing in Russian. Our next European Classics book club is Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. That's the last Friday of October. I'm Michael Williams. My thanks to the team here, executive producer Rhiannon Brown, producers Georgia Moody, Kate Evans, Sarah Lestrange, Suzanne Donisthorpe, Anita Barad, and Doug Spencer. But we've just got time to throw to Bush Telegraph quickly. Cam, what's coming up on the show?
A couple of things of interest. How you can ask Any question you might have about gardening or your veggie patch, you can now ask the world's very best farmers how to become a better gardener. We'll tell you how that works. And also we'll try to pinpoint the very first recreational bushwalk in Australia. This is a controversial story.
Oh, it sounds highly controversial. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you all. I'll be back next week. Books and Arts.
Jackie Frank is the editor and publisher of Marie Claire Australia. She launched it 19 years ago and is still responsible for every page of the magazine that mixes high fashion and proper journalism.
We're just putting to bed the November issue. I actually did the cover yesterday. We finished and signed off on the cover lines and the way that it looks. At the same time, we've been laying out the pages for December and we've been planning January.
Jackie Frank on the Media Report. Listen anytime at the RN website.